Hi, Chief Halton here at Fire Engineering Podcasts, and we are being brought to you by Tenkata Protective Fabrics and their Made for Life podcast hosted by Stuart Perry. The Made for Life podcast unearths the work experiences of real men and women who rely on the protective clothing and equipment to get the job done. From firefighters to industrial workers to military personnel, recent episodes explore the dangers and challenges of wildland firefighting, peer counseling for first responders, and the ins and outs of turnout gear. It's the Made for Life podcast from Tenkata Fabrics. Find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And thank you for listening to Fire Engineering.
All right, so we want to thank everybody for tuning in to the Generation Engine podcast again. If you've been listening, you probably know we usually have a few co-hosts, but we're going to be missing two of them tonight. So, but we do have two guests that I think have plenty of information to share to make up for it. So if you're new to the show, my name's Anthony Rowett. I'm a captain with the Mobile Fire Rescue Department in Mobile, Alabama. Been in the fire service for about 15 years, been with Mobile for 13. But I'm going to get straight to who everyone's probably here to listen to, being our two guests, and let them introduce themselves. So, Dennis, if you want to introduce yourself.
My name is Dennis Laguerre. I'm a retired captain from the Oakland, California Fire Department, and I've been involved with the UL-FSRI studies, mainly extreme study and coordinated attack studies, and I've run a consulting company that helps fire departments examine water flow and fire stream development from the hydrant all the way to nozzles, from hand lines to master streams and building infrastructure from pre-93 to post-93 buildings. And that's pretty much what I've been doing for the last 10 years. And I've been involved in the fire service now about my 27th year.
Awesome. And Daryl, you'd like to introduce yourself?
Hi, everybody. Thanks for tuning in. So I'm kind of Dennis's partner in crime, so to speak. I'm a captain in the Oakland Fire Department. I just came off the engine 2 weeks ago to come down to the training division, where it'll most likely be my final ride into the sunset. So I'm seeing the department from a different perspective. I'm the training captain here at Oakland, and it's my 29th year. Here in California, we can retire after 50. So, I'm getting close to the finish line, but I still hold the same passion I've always had. Dennis and I used to work together at the same firehouse a couple times. I'm the chair of what we call the hose and nozzle committee, and also we have an engine working group, and they put me as the chair of the engine working group. Probably just another name for a committee. But Dennis has always been part of that committee, and even in my latest proposal, we're looking at some 2 1/4-inch hose, which we know Dennis really kind of started, brought to the to light. His name is on that, even as a retired member. He's still having an influence on how things are done. So, yeah, I can say I'm an engine guy. I stayed on what is our busiest single house until, a couple weeks ago. I still have a passion for the job, and I'm still trying to improve what we do. So that's pretty much about me.
Great. And I'm glad you brought something up, because it's going to lead us into our first topic with the 2 1/4. It's something my job actually bought. I guess we've had it a little over probably a year now for our standpipe operations. We went to that, and guys have been big on using it if they have to extend line longer than we have on the rig, and they're going all 2.5. They're actually starting to extend using those working lengths, using their high-rise bundles, because we still use an 1 1/8 tip on it, and they're getting that reduced water weight, and they found a lot of success with it. So talking about things like that and Dennis's involvement with it. If Dennis, you want to start on the first topic, it's going to be the idea of building an attack package, the importance of actually, putting an attack package together that's taking into account both nozzle and hose, not not as an individual component, but as one complete package. And the importance of that and different aspects of that that you look at when you're doing consulting for people and trying to help them with that topic.
Well, I would be remiss not to mention another retired captain from Oakland named Jay Camella. You know, with Daryl, Jay, and me working with our department around a nozzle study. And I was more on the supply side. You know, Daryl and Jay really got me interested in hand lines. And I was one of the test engines. I was an engineer at the time. And I remember they sent out different hose and nozzle combinations. So Jay did write an article. I think it's like planning effective hose and nozzle package or something like that. You can look up on Fire Engineering. That was a very popular article at the time, sometime around 2002. But that being said, what Ann Darrell's approach really showed to me is what you really need to do is you need to develop your knowledge and understanding of what you're trying to accomplish. And then you need to have a systems mindset, especially in water movement. You know, in hand lines, you're looking at not only the fire stream that's coming out of the nozzle, but everything that's moving the water too. So the hose spec itself and when it kinks, when it doesn't kink, how it folds and how it packs and trade-offs around that. And then you should demo or train with your top couple choices before you buy your equipment. And we were lucky enough to work for a large agency, so we didn't have really a hard time working with vendors. By the way, vendors are not the devil. Salesmen are not the devil either. You know, trust but verify, you know, information that you're getting. You know, work with your suppliers to test equipment before you purchase. You know, there you have a duty to act in a professional manner. And one of those things is buyer beware. You know, ultimately, when the fire department is buying equipment, they are the customer. And just like you would buy a used car, for example, you're just not going to take the other party's word for it. You know, I don't think there's any intentional misdirection, but there are some issues with knowledge around these products and what exactly each of these things. So just I'm going to just yell out four things here. You know, when I teach a class called the Big Four of Handline Attack Package Design, I start at the nozzle and I work my way back to the pump panel. And if you're embarking on this as a member of a committee or something like this, the number one thing you have to get done is your nozzle design. You need to know what nozzle pressure, and we can discuss what each of these things do, but you need to know what nozzle pressure you're selecting. You need to know how heavy your nozzle is. Hint, hint, lighter is better. As long as it doesn't impact durability. You need to look at your reaction force and how your stream velocity, which is affected by nozzle pressure, and your reach. And very critically, you need your target flow. If you don't have that, you can't move forward because nozzle pressure will affect kind of hose you can buy. And the next thing you're looking at is the hose, you know, the materials, the weave, the construction type, you know, and some of the stuff that you should be looking at under hose construction performance-wise, you know, packability, kinkability, and the trade-offs there. Once you have that, you can kind of look at some of the hydraulic functions, like how fast the water's traveling through the hose. How heavy the system is, how big the hose actually is. One of the things that I think has been really pushed by the hose manufacturing industry is that very low friction loss is the sign of a good hose. And that is just absolutely not true. Like that's, you can have a hose with an extremely low friction loss that's marketed 1.75 inches, and it can be nearly 2 inches. And be very inexpensively constructed or expensively constructed. And you can have a hose that is has a much higher friction loss, but it actually has an internal diameter closer to 1 3/4, which means the water's traveling through the hose quicker at the same flow, and you get a lot of benefits from that. So there's these kind of fallacies out there. And then the final thing you need to really pay attention to is your pump panel itself. You know, not everybody's designing new rigs, but if you have an old rig, you should be, you know, capping all your discharges and using the drains and making sure your pressure gauges are reading, you know, within reasonable, correct pressures. And if you have a rear discharge, it always seems to overpump a line or something like that. You know, you might find a bad gauge, or maybe you have a cross lay that has a lot of turns in the plumbing and the pickups before that, and you feel like the line's always underpumped. You know, it's very common for crosslays to have at 160 gallons a minute to have about an extra 10 PSI on the pump panel to overcome the friction loss in the chickstand swivel, that little swivel device at the crossway. So it's really those four things: nozzle design, hose construction, hose size and its implications, and then the pump panel. And to get a true gold standard system, you have to have good knowledge around those things. Daryl,
all right,
great.
Yeah, I want to get Daryl's thoughts, and then Dennis, I want to come back and have you build off of something you brought up too. So, Daryl, what would you like to add on the idea of like Dennis said, a system approach to a hose and nozzle attack package versus just nozzle and just simply hoses, individual components rather than the combined system?
Well, in some of the changes that we made in our own organization, Dennis was really technical and had a good understanding of a lot of the details of the inner workings of hose and nozzles. I was not as technical, but I knew what I wanted changed. And unfortunately, the change that we were looking for came after a line of duty death that we had, and it touched the department. So we had a board of inquiry report that, was a big motivator. It talked of basically needing to improve flows. A ledger board burned away in a two-story building that was just an older wooden building, and it caused a second floor collapse, ending two careers killing one officer. And so we had a battalion chief at the time that was a big supporter of making that change. So the first thing I would want is just have a clear understanding of why you're changing or looking to make a modification to what you're doing, because we can't do this because the neighbors are doing it or because it's a trend, just because it's popular. That's why a lot of departments ended up with automatic nozzles and 5-inch hose, or some even with 1 3/4 when they weren't even increasing their flows. You have to have a clear understanding of that whole package. If your target flow is 95 GPM, then why are you going to 1 3/4 hose? You know, so we had a clear understanding of some of the stuff that we wanted to do, and I would just encourage anybody to make sure that's the first thing. The other part of this package is unfortunately timing. We all have roadblocks in our organizations, depending on if it's money, maybe a roadblock. It could be an operations chief. It could be your own boss. It could just be whatever other priorities the department needs to focus on. So having the proper timing of implementing that change is also going to be something that is important. When you come back from a conference and you're energetic and you want to get those irons you saw or that nozzle you saw or whatever it is, a thermal imager, just make sure you have a clear understanding of why you want it, and then make sure that you're focusing on the timing. And the other thing is being open-minded during the process. We often go into these changes or modifications. Change is sometimes just too strong of a word for people, but we're looking to improve what we do. Like any sports team, anybody involved in something should be looking to improve what they do, whether it's in the gym or, you know, photography. You know, we're looking to make an improvement. And for that to happen, we have to stay open-minded during the process, because we may modify our way of thinking. Maybe a new product comes out midstream, or you learn other things during that process. So don't be too hard-headed. Make sure you're listening to people along the way. Another thing is be inclusive with other people. There's going to be a lot of people that want something to say, and people don't want these changes just to be put upon them. There's a lot of experience in your organization. A lot of people have different experience, and maybe their experience wasn't, technically correct to, maybe they describe a flashover or something like that, or a situation where they needed a piece of equipment you're looking at getting rid of or something, or changing. Their experience was true to them. So, listen and understand. And another is, you are going to have to follow your own reputation. If you've been in a recliner your whole career and you're at jobs not really being one that people associate with doing good work, that's your reputation. So your reputation is really going to play a strong role. And the people that you bring onto your team, you want them to have good reputations as well as good technical knowledge and be open-minded. And if you're leading that group, let them know, the expectations. You don't want to engage in arguments with people. Once people start arguing, it's really not – nobody's going to win. But, encourage discussions. So, as far as building the package, I think we're still learning. I'm still learning today. I mean, this last proposal that you mentioned with 2.25 is something, 29 years into my career now. And I'm still learning along the way. And like I said, stay open, because things may change and we're all learning along the way. The other part of this, I would say, is sometimes we get too technical. When we went into this change back in 2002, we had disagreements among ourselves. The 15/16ths, most notably, was a tip I personally was not a big proponent of. I didn't feel like it would be as common as it is if it wasn't backed by a department with four letters of the F, D, and Y. And I could be wrong on that, but looking at the technical information, sure, we could always say more water is going to put out fire faster. But is that true? Because for me, there was a big part of it is, how does this feel in my hands? Being realistic about the people that you are going to be working with this. And when, doing a lot of training, a lot of drills, watching a lot of other people handle it, I felt this is too much. This is kind of breaking that barrier of being a user-friendly piece of equipment, and we decided to go with the 7/8. But those are some of the main things I like to focus on when we were making some of the changes.
Great. A bunch of good points there from both of you, and some personal point I can add to that to talk about what you guys are talking about is two different times in my career where in my job some changes have been made to our hose or nozzles individually versus as a system as a whole, and then later in my career where we made the change, like with the 2.25 for the standpipe operations, where it was done and everything was evaluated as one system versus individually. And years back, we had made a change, and we were running 200 GPM at 100 PSI adjustable fog nozzles with I won't say which hose, but it's marketed as lightweight, we'll say that, and weak construction, how about that? And they looked at it from a stance of, we want to do something better for the guys. It's going to be easier for them as far as management of the line. So the department went out without doing a bunch of testing and just bought a bunch of 150 GPM at 50 PSI nozzles and just threw it on the hose. No training on it, nothing, just put it out in the field and replaced the nozzles. And people started going to fires and having huge kink problems because we weren't getting enough pressure in the hose to prevent the kinks now with the hose construction that we had, because we looked at it as just a single piece and not as a system. And luckily it's a big enough city, big enough job that when they put the committee together, found the problem, that the department, you know, was able to financially fix it. It took years to get, you know, all the frontline engines and apparatus to have new nozzles and new hose, but there was an immediate move to, once they addressed the, or they identified the issue, to address it. But if you didn't have, you know, the resources being a bigger city to do that, then you just, because you looked at it as an individual piece that we're going to get this low pressure nozzle and you didn't look at the system, and they couldn't have, you know, put new hose on the truck as an emergency purchase to at least get, you know, so much hose on every truck until the next budget year to buy more hose. And they did it. It took to get all the reserve apparatus and everything. That happened last year. So it's been probably going on 8-9 years that it took to get all of the old construction hose out of the system, an inch and three quarter. And if you weren't able to do that, you just made a purchase that's going to last, you know, 15-20 years with that nozzle package that you now have a problem with, because the hose isn't going to be compatible with it. Versus the last, when they actually put the hose and nozzle committee, we got a new administration came in. The way our hose and nozzle package for standpipes decided to be evaluated was through, actually, our operations chief went to HROC. Dennis, I think you might have met him while we were there. I don't think you were there that year, Daryl. And he started talking to a lot of people, and he came back and said, we've got to make some changes. There was already a hose and nozzle committee, you know, working to get those changes made, and it was just going a lot slower than a lot of us on that committee necessarily would have liked. But being close to Pensacola, we were able to get the second in charge to go there. And he went, he listened, he heard guys like Chief McGrail talk, Ray talk, Dennis talk, and came back and said, we've got to make a change, and really started pushing for a change to be made. And then when that one was done, it was done as a true systems approach. We had, like Dennis, you were talking about, the vendors came out, and we had every model of hose from every company that was willing to send it that we were out there evaluating, with different nozzles and tips and all different sorts of things to truly look at how the whole system was going to operate. And when we implemented that change, that we didn't experience the problems we had with the first one. We didn't experience the pushback from the guys in the field that we had with the first one, when they started having problems with, you know, they had a kink and then they just lost faith in the whole system, which was fair because it didn't match the hose. But this time it was done. A lot of people were brought in to get that buy-in. It wasn't just necessarily the hose and nozzle committee that did it. When we got to kind of the final evaluations, we were down to a few options. When we were down there, we called in other companies and just had them train with it. And then they were able to go back, and it started getting that word out in the field too that, hey, I like this. It was actually, you know, they'd had bad experiences with 2.5, and a lot of the things we were running into was people getting that bigger flow. They had a bad experience where, you know, they didn't think they could hold it. We got out there, we did some, you know, some training with it, and by the end they were like, man, I'm all about that. We want it. So I think you can see from the two experiences we've had in my career where the department has made a change to hose and nozzles like that. One was done as a systems approach and didn't run into all these problems, got the buy-in from the department when it was put in service, what had training for the department once it went in service on it, versus one that was not done as a system. It was, we want to get these low pressure nozzles we've heard about because that'll make life easier for our members, and didn't evaluate the hose you were going to put it with, and they weren't compatible at all. So just to go on to what you guys are talking about as a system, those are the two experiences I've seen in my job itself, where one was done as a system and one was done individually. But Dennis, I want to go back to one thing you said for people, because I hear from people talk about this all the time. When you're talking about the pump panel and the gauge is not necessarily being accurate all the time, I think a lot of people, at least from my experience talking to people, they take they take that gauge for granted if they haven't kind of tested to see how, you know, how far off their gauges might be based on, like you said, chicks and swivels or crossway versus rear, how far the pickup tube is and all that kind of stuff. So would you mind going into that a little bit, just give guys an idea of what to look for, what to expect, versus just thinking it's always necessarily the same across the board for every gauge that they get, every line on the rig, like you say, crossway versus rear and things like that.
Yeah, I can do that. So, you know, when you're looking at these rigs, you know, I'll got some few things that I think are important. Okay, you know, there's NFPA standards for this. You know, I'm probably going to be doing this from memory. I think they allow 10% plus or minus when they're doing any annual gauge check. So, you know, the error can be big. But one of the first things when I'm teaching pump panel operations as an engineer or as a pump operator and you're pumping hand line, I might put some tape over the main gauge. You get in a habit of looking at your main gauge next to your compound gauge. It's the easiest one to read, and this hurts you as a pump operator. You know, it's that pickup's right at the volute of the pump, and it's reading pump discharge pressure, not outlet discharge pressure. The gauge next to the handle that you pull to charge the outlet, the one you should be paying attention to, unless it's obviously reading way inaccurate, like it's broken or something. And hopefully the hydraulic pickup for that gauge is within 3 inches of the discharge it serves and that there's no change of direction from where the pickup is. Now, we know in crosslays that have kickcan swivels, we know that you're going to have at least a few change in directions. And, you know, imagine if you go out onto a track and field track, and one person, you're running 100-meter dash or something, and one person's doing the hurdle and the other person isn't doing the hurdle. Obviously, the person that's not jumping hurdles is going to go down the pathway easier. So now imagine if the thing that's reading the board, the hurdle, so downstream, the kickstand swivel, there's these two turns. It means that pressure gauge is going to read light. And as the volume goes up, you know, at 100, it might have been if you were in an attack package that only flowed 100 gallons a minute and your department changed to a 15, 16 tip, and now you're stuffing 185 gallons a minute through that kickstand swivel. It happens to be a smaller one, let's say 2-inch or something. All of a sudden, that gauge at 185 gallons a minute is not going to record the friction loss downstream. And a problem you didn't have before, you have now. So, you know, you kind of have to look at this stuff in detail. You know, some of the ways that I would try to get rid of that when I was speccing a rig would be to upsize the size of that plumbing. Like I would just, oh, you're going to want to flow up to 200 gallons a minute in your 1¾. You're going with a 15/16 or something. Let's do a 2.5-inch kickstand swivel. We'll end it with a 2.5 to 1.5 reducer. So now I can make sure that gauge reads correctly. You know, those are the little nuances. But definitely pay attention to the gauge that you're pumping. Think of it like you're running down that track. If you tilt the cab and you're looking at the plumbing and you're looking at the little hydraulic pickup lines, and by the way, really well-specced rigs, the little hydraulic pickup line will color match the handle. So if crossplay number one is the yellow handle, the yellow drain tube, the yellow drain tube and the yellow hydraulic pickup will match that gauge. So you can kind of trace them around inside the doghouse of the pump. And you'll start to realize that, hey, some of these pressure pickups have substantial changes in direction downstream. So the gauge is reading where that pickup is. So is this a surmountable problem? You know, I remember – you know, there was a guy named Mac McGarry and Mark Lighthill, who happens to be the president, Vice President Key Hose right now, used to have a consulting company, and they'd come out and make a pump chart per rig, and it used to be pretty bad. And then people started learning more about it, and rigs got spec'd a little bit better. You know, I'm down to the point where, you know, one of the guys I work with, Rick Mosier, who helps me with rig design from Olathe, Kansas, there's actually a Pierce option number now that is attributed to Rick and I. You put in the option number and you basically get the plumbing pickups and design that we would do on rigs that we're working with. So, you know, I'm trying to engineer myself out of a job. You know, I love the fire service. Firestream development is the bread and butter of extinguishment, and, you know, little details matter, you know, and I, you know, I don't think Daryl was taking a dig at me. Like when I, you know, he says, like, you know, sometimes you can get over technical, but ultimately spec and layout drives strategy and tactics on the fire ground. And if you have a shitty designed pump system, or your cross lays are high, or hose bed doesn't hold, you got to use bundles when you're making extensions. You can't have bulk beds on your rig. Same thing applies to hand attack package design. You should put the work in. We were very lucky in Oakland. Way down in the contributing factors, it definitely wasn't why we had two people lose their careers and one person die on scene. The hose and nozzle package was a contributing factor. There was a lot of other things at the CUNY line of duty death fire. But what it allowed Daryl, as the head of the hose and nozzle committee, and the chief that was working with it, there was a large sum of money set aside to make a lot of changes all at once. So, like, you know, very few fire departments the size of Oakland get this opportunity. So you can't screw it up. Would I do the same things that we did then now? A lot of them, yes. Some of the things that are available now weren't available then. Some of the knowledge that I have now, or understanding that I have now, I didn't develop then. Never, ever, when Daryl says, don't argue with people, I totally agree, right? But that being said, conversations where I've learned the most are debates that are at times heated, or, you know, there has to be some conflict. And the way I try to explain this to chiefs and also personnel trying to initiate change in the fire department is that passion, right? The reason people are upset when you're making changes is usually because they think what you're doing is going to, or what you're advocating for is going to make them less effective at their job. It's going to make them less effective at saving lives and property. So if you take it that perspective in the complaining party shoes, and they say what was going to make them less effective. Well, one of the things that was brought up is, hey, inch and three quarters is a lot bigger than an inch and a half. It's harder to move around. If I was still involved with the city of Oakland on a professional capacity, would I buy the same inch and three quarter that they are currently in? Very good hose. There's nothing wrong with it. I do think there's probably hose that's a little bit smaller and easier to handle. Would I go back to inch and a half hose? No, I think inch and a half hose is too small for a 160 gallon minute stream. And I think 150, 160 gallons a minute pretty much guarantees you in a residential compartment, if you have adjacent compartment flashover and you have a large body of thermal energy heading to you and you're smart enough to have the stream open and playing about aggressively in the overhead, it's probably a survivable event. So, you know, I don't think these numbers are just picked out of thin air, but don't ever – I'm going to throw just a couple anecdotal stories and then I'm going to stop so other people can speak. But Dallas took delivery. You know, I'm fortunate. I go all over the country. I have connections in all sorts of fire departments. Dallas took delivery of four new Pierce engines. It came with a hose and nozzle package that was slightly different than what they were used to. And they had a failure on a fire ground where there was a lot of kinks. And it was a hose that I, you know, was involved in developing. I don't make any money from it. It was just an area of passion. And this video comes to me, and it's on social media, and I can see what happened. You know, this stiffer hose, like True ID, you should charge it more aggressively. And when you lay it out, you should lay it out with less kinks in it. But once you get water to the nozzle and you have good pressure and you have good flow with the nozzle, then it's going to be less kinkable. But on the initial dry layout, if you put a lot of dry kinks in it and then you gently charge a discharge, it's heavy hose. If it resists kinking once it's charged, it means it's heavy and stiff. Well, that means you have to get good water through it. So it was a training failure. The Denver Fire Department, when they were messing with their hose, some guys in the Denver Fire Department years ago identified hose that worked better with low-pressure nozzles. And one of the reasons I got interested in hose was talking to the Denver Fire Department, and they're like, oh, yeah, this old, I think it was Pond Supreme at the time, we like this on a nozzle length so that the nozzle doesn't whip around. I'm like, well, that's different. No one's ever said that before. So never discount a person that's not technical. If they've made a field observation and it's reproducible, then you have to go figure out why. And then so I'm talking to a guy in Duluth, Andy Goltz, and he's like, oh, yeah, companies are putting older Pond Supreme as the first 100 feet because we just switched the low-pressure nozzles and it works better. And I'm like, okay, this is when I started, you know, 6, 7 years ago, 8 years ago. I'm like, okay, hose is super important. What do we not know as firefighters about hose? Is it what do we not know about weft, warp, weave, denier? Why are these older hoses performing better than these newer hoses? And is this something that we can do as professionals to improve the hose and nozzle package nationwide? And I think the efforts of many people have led to a situation where there is good product out there for nozzle pressures between 40 and 60 in target flow ranges of 150 to 185 gallons a minute in your inch and three-quarter line that will make you substantially better at extinguishing fire. So, you know, it's good to call out the manufacturer and what you're looking for in hose.
All right, so before we move on to our next topic, I thought of one more thing I'd like that I do hear a good bit, and I'd like you two to talk about a little bit or give your stance on it and explanation of it. But the idea that you hear a lot of people say is against pulling a 2.5-inch hose is we'll just pull 2 inch and 3 quarters, and that's the thing, but easier. And the extinguishment power of an actual 2.5 with the mass of that stream versus 2 inch and 3 quarters and the benefit of actually pulling the 2.5. As we talk about attack packages where having that a good attack package with that 2.5 you guys are able to use and they're comfortable with, and how much actual extinguishment power it has when it comes into that idea that we could just pull 2 inch and 3 quarters and that's the same as a 2.5. So Daryl, what do you think? What are your thoughts?
Well, you know, we've heard this for a very long time, and I have been very impressed with how much fire an inch and three-quarter line can put out. There's been several fires where I believe that 2.5 should have been stretched, an inch and three-quarter was stretched, and we had good results. Now, was it the right thing to do, or was it, was it luck? I just look at it as kind of learning the capabilities of that weapon, and that 7/8 tip is quite the weapon. That's one thing. I don't think that's wavered in the years that we've went from this. However, when it comes to stream reach, the 2.5 is going to have a longer stream reach. So when it comes to these commercial buildings, the grocery stores, the church, the office building, it's not just the volume of water, which people focus on. The stream reach is also important. So for my job, I had recently made a video just comparing the stream reach between an inch and three quarter, a 2.5, and the RAM, which we have on our engines as of last year, and showing the progression in stream reach. But I think the fallacy of this, 2 inch and 3 quarters versus a 2.5 is it's easier said than done. I mean, I'm fortunate compared to most of the country that I'm working in a department with 4 people on an engine. Okay. It takes twice as many people to have 2-inch and 3-quarter lines for what people are saying can accomplish the same thing as 1 2.5. If I had that many people, I would, having 2-inch and 3-quarter lines, it's still going to be quite a cluster. You have to have 2 nozzle firefighters. You have to have 2 officers that are directing these lines. You have to have 2 people backing up, 2 people at the door. So you're doubling your need of personnel to operate these 2-inch and 3-quarter lines. It's a fallacy. Does 2.5 take more people to move forward? Yes, it does, but it doesn't take twice as many people as it does of 1-inch and 3-quarter. So I think it's very important for departments with lesser staffing to really think about these larger lines in comparison to the smaller lines. It's more important that you're thinking about using the larger line than the 1-inch and 3-quarter. Large departments can get away with it at times simply because they have the people that I just described that are going to be needed for multiple smaller lines. But it's interesting that we think of 1-inch and 3-quarter and 2.5 that way, because nobody is debating to have, you know, 3 real lines or booster lines as opposed to a single 1.5 or 1-inch and 3-quarter, or, you know, 2 2.5 versus a RAM monitor operating. So I do think it's kind of a fallacy. And you know what? When I was listening to Dennis talk about this, the gauges, it just reminded me that we have to remember where a lot of our members came from and the history and the conditions that they've been doing their job in. When Dennis and I came in, the city of Oakland had these rigs called West States. Now, what was funny about the West States, and I don't know if this was spec or whatever, it was basically the cheapest fire engine you could get. And, you know, they were going to fires and putting them out. But it had 3 crosslays, and the crosslays had no gauges. I still remember Dennis disconnecting the pigtail off of a crosslay to disconnect it and hook it to a discharge at the pump panel so he could have a reading of the pressure. And these 3 crosslays were all 3 different lengths. There was a 150, a 200, and a 300. There was essentially no way to know what pressure you were pumping to these lines unless you did something like what he did. So we were now in the position of training engineers to deal with some technical issues when they weren't even dealing with gauges on a day-to-day basis. They charged the line, and we were very fortunate that, you know, 1.5, I guess, in some ways was, you know, very forgiving, you know, unlike a 2.5 with a smooth bore, which is going to be very unforgiving. But keep in mind what the workers in your city have been used to when it comes to making these changes. And, you know, when you guys were talking, it reminded me of a couple of other stories still on building that attack package. Some people are looking to make it a change. I remember a friend coming over to our tower to flow. He's in a suburb of us, and he wanted to evaluate some hose and some nozzles. When we put the smoothbore nozzle he was trying to get in his city on their hose, which happened to be Key Eco 10, I think it was called, it was absolutely awful. It was kinking like crazy. Now, not a bad hose for what it's intended use for. And this is where vendors come into play. They can educate you. So we contact the vendor, tell them what's going on. It's like, that hose should not be used with 50 PSI nozzles or even 75 PSI nozzles for that matter. So had he just made the change, here, I got the 7/8 I've been fighting for and put it on the line, everybody would have a terrible experience, and they're not going to attribute it to the hose. They're going to attribute it to the nozzle. They're going to say, hey, we got those smoothbore nozzles. It was absolutely terrible. Never do that again. Give me back my 100 PSI nozzle and be done with it. So we really have to look at every component when we're building the package. And just most recently, as we're evaluating 2.25, we still have this large nozzle. It's nowhere near the type of nozzle I would prefer, but we have a 250 at 50. It's a huge low pressure fog nozzle. I don't think should be anywhere near a fire engine. However, we also have an inch and an eighth. Our current 2.5 flows the 250 at 50 just fine. I think there's some misunderstandings in the application of that type of stream. However, it physically doesn't work really with our 2.25. The hose is much lighter and it doesn't handle the sheer weight of that nozzle as well as the larger 2.5-inch hose does. So here we have a system now where that's just going to have to be eliminated out of the system because of the weight. Now, is it a problem with the nozzle? No. Is it a problem with the hose? No. It's a problem that the system doesn't work together. So we can't, beat our head against the wall that we want both because both don't work together. Okay.
Yeah, great point. And that's your first story there is exactly what we ran into when I was talking about that first change we made. It was Key Eco 10 hose and going to 150 at 50 fog, and it just didn't work. But Dennis, do you have anything you want to add before we move on to the argument of 2 inch and 3/4 being the same as 1 2.5?
Yeah, I'm going to go back and try to maybe make some analogies that people will understand why a single stream from a larger hose line that's not even double the volume. Let's say your target flow is 160 gallons a minute and you pull your 2.25 and you're flowing 265, or you pull your 2.5 and you're flowing 265. Why in a larger compartment that single hand line flowing 2 160s is 320, 265. It's about, 80 gallons less a minute or whatever it is, 60 gallons less a minute. Why would I still pull the single larger hand line? And I think Daryl, when I go back to respecting field observations, right? He's talking about how much fire can be put out with 1 3/4 flowing 160 gallons a minute from that 7/8-inch tip. So if you do all of the math around raising a British thermal unit and how many are in a gallon of water and everything, you come out with a number that roughly per 100 gallons a minute delivered to a surface, you get a million BTU absorption. So 160 gallons a minute is 1.6 million BTUs per minute, and 265 gallons a minute would be 2.65 million BTU per minute. Now, we're not synchronized swimmers. If you have 2 3/4 on the fire ground and they're flowing into a commercial space, are they going to hit in a single spot and rapidly cool a single spot? Because efficiency and extinguishment occurs at the surface. And what you want is you want a concentrated area of cooling as you move that stream apart. You won't get that with the two smaller hand lines, because once a surface is cool, it's done. It's no longer it's no longer re-radiating into the room if it was a burning area. So you get much more rapid cooling. So it's like you're dumping a whole bucket of water in one spot instead of two half buckets of water in two different spots. Now, and this is very important as the compartment gets bigger. Now, the other thing that I don't think a lot of instructors talk about, Daryl said he compared reach in Oakland recently. Now, that's on the drill ground. And one of the problems with that is there's no heat. And when I talk about 1 3/4 lines versus 2.5, and I've just gone to calling them small lines versus large lines, because I think 2.25 is a very good option for the American service as a rig line. That being said, that small flow versus large flow, 160 versus 265 to 300, I say the 1 3/4 line is like a tennis ball, and the 2.5-inch line or large stream is like a baseball. So at 50 PSI nozzle pressure, the water is leaving the nozzles at the same speed. It's leaving at 85 feet per second. Why does a baseball travel farther than a tennis ball? It has more mass. So it takes a little more energy to throw at the same speed. It's going to go. That's what Daryl sees on the drill ground. Oh, it has like 10 more feet of reach. Now put heat into the equation. Now, I have some tick footage that shows 160 gallons a minute in a super high heated compartment around 1,500 degrees Fahrenheit at the ceiling. You're getting like only 20 feet of reach, 20, 30 feet of reach. The stream just evaporates at 25, 30 feet, traveling at 85 feet per second when it leaves the nozzle, and a tennis ball has less mass. It's going to evaporate quicker. And then you have your 2.5-inch hand line, right, that you have your two personnel on. They've concentrated all their water into a baseball. Baseball's heavier. It's not going to evaporate as quick, right? So instead of only going 20 feet in, it might go 40 feet in. Now you go, okay, well, 40 feet. 40 feet, if you're at the corner of a building, 40 by 40 is 1,600 square feet. 20 by 20 is only 400 square feet. The 2-inch and 3-quarter lines in that high heat condition might only have a footprint of extinguishment of around 400 square feet. And a 2.5 in the same position has 4 times the extinguishment footprint because of the mass of water, right? Because you're not adding the streams together on the 1-3-quarter. So they're absolutely dissimilar in the large compartment. So I caution people to thinking that pulling multiple 1-3-quarters. And one of the reasons I designed 2-1/4-inch hose is there's some excellent fire departments out there. City of San Francisco, DC are two examples that have very mobile, very good small hand line games. And they've really got mobility and placement of water down good. But they haven't realized this other component of the large stream. That I think that they could advance. But those departments are very used to working in very tight cities, tight hallways, even in their commercial structures, racking really tight. And maybe the 2.5-inch hose wasn't the right answer. So maybe I needed to do something else for those types of agencies. That's kind of what the ball rolling with the 2.25. You know, I've just talked to some members of the Montreal Fire Department, very similar to San Francisco and D.C., and built environment. So the built environment dictates this a lot. The body of fire, the size of the compartment, that heat. Now, just to give you another example where people aren't thinking about this, you put a ram monitor at the door. You go, oh, it'll have twice the extinguishing power of a 250 or a 2-1/8. You know, 2-2.5 are the same as the ram monitor. The ram monitor flowing 500 gallons a minute at 80 PSI, not only is it double the mass concentrated in one place, right? Now you're doing it at a much higher velocity, which we're going to talk about later. But in 80 PSI, 1-3-8 tip, now that water is leaving the nozzle at 105 feet per second. So it's more mass and it's traveling farther away. So in a heated compartment, it's going to have much more reach than a 2.5-inch hand line. So that's the way we really need to think about it. The size of the bullet has changed in the mass, and heat attacks the bullet. So these have vastly different reaches in large compartments that are superheated.
Yeah, that's the way I heard you talk about it a few years ago in mass, and that's what always made me or where my brain always went to it after hearing you of, you know, kind of how to explain it when people say it to me is to focus on mass. But moving on, since we've talked a lot about attack packages and kind of got into it already, but Daryl, as the chair of your committee there in Oakland, when you're doing an attack package study, a hose and nozzle study, what are kind of the things you're looking for as you set it up and you plan it? And I know we've already talked a lot about the package and some of the testing and the system approach and all that, but on things we haven't touched on yet, what are you kind of in your mind thinking of as you're setting that up as that chairperson?
Well, yeah, like I said earlier, it is having a very clear understanding of what we're trying to accomplish. But I'm trying to think of administrations, which we're calling our chiefs and people that are going to be in the position of making the decisions to spend money on this equipment or be this ones that have to defend this change or implement this change. So I try to puzzle in a way that is going to give them all the answers they need. Now being at training, I have more of a insight of how all the wheels are turning in an organization. And although some people may think that their issue isn't getting addressed enough, you have to realize there's a lot of other issues. And what's important to you is not the most important thing for them. So kind of irregardless of what the decision is, your name is going to be on that change, and you want to make sure that it's the right change. So you have to make sure that you give administration all the information they can use to make it an undoubtedly good decision. So one I always touch on is safety, and it's how is this going to make us safe? And if we decide not to do this, how is it going to make us less safe? The other thing is training. How are we going to train people on what you're proposing? You know, what's the timeline? You know, is this stuff we're doing online as well as hands-on? Right now, we're about to implement 2.25 and we're in the middle of a drought. So I'm trying to, you know, figure that out. We have some drafting options we're going to have to try to implement. So the public perception isn't that we're wasting water having everybody flow, you know, 2.5-inch hand lines for training, but you have to have that answer. The cost. Let them know exactly what the cost is, and if you can choose a time where it's actually not going to be cost neutral, we happen to have a time where we need to replace hose anyway. When we changed our initial hose and nozzle package, we had a grant, but we also had a need to replace stuff anyway, so it was just an opportune time for us changing our supply line nozzles and attack hose. Like I said, your reputation is going to play a part in that, because they're going to know who you are. So when you give them the package to, you know, your proposal, make sure you're just covering all the bases. Whatever your organization is, you think you're going to want the answers to, don't expect to talk about this at the kitchen table and then somebody's going to pick it up. You have to be the one to do the work. Do all the hard work and give them everything that they're going to need, so they have very little questions. All they have to do is rubber stamp it upstairs. But just make them feel confident that this is the right change for your city, not because of the neighbors or a big city next to you. And this has worked several times. I've had the good fortune to make many changes, and they weren't all fire related. When I was a paramedic here, we changed our drug boxes. You know, we implemented this RAM. We've made plenty of changes to different corners of the organization. And also, be honest with yourself and the rest of the members of your team if you're the proper person to make the change. I remember when we were, you know, I wanted thermal imagers for the longest time, but I had enough on my plate. I wasn't going to be the thermal imager expert, but I was willing to help out wherever I could, but I wasn't going to be the lead person. So sometimes you need to empower other people to be part of that change.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, especially right there at the end with other people too. Dennis, with you being in a different role where someone's actually, it's not your organization necessarily anymore, someone's bringing you in to evaluate, you know, their system and all that. So it's not you trying to send something up to your administration to see if you can get a change. They're actually calling you in and asking you to evaluate what they need to do. What are you looking for as you're setting that up and going through that process?
I think Chief Dave Rhodes kind of gave me some good advice years ago that he said, I think he called it inbox mining. And there's something I noticed as a consultant. If you get to the point where you're asking someone for outside perspective, usually something that Daryl mentioned earlier, if they've gotten to a point where there's either a lot of argument that have occurred and no one, they haven't come to a conclusion, or they know something needs to occur, they don't want a mistake, but the fire chief's not confident that the information that has been provided is 100% accurate, or they're doing a trust but verify. So often when I leave, people are happy because I get to their inbox and somebody will have like a hydrant bag proposal and say, hey, we need gate valves. We need to teach people how to use multiple outlets. We need pumps on hydrants. Someone's already done what Daryl has mentioned, the proposal, and it's gotten into the operations chief's inbox and over to logistics chief or whatever, and it gets quashed. Well, we haven't done this before, or, oh, well, that's nice, but it's not the time, or who knows? Maybe there's some other emergency in the department that needs to take place, like they fell out of certification of one thing or the other, or they're having a big review, ISO review, so the ball gets dropped. So often what I tell fire chiefs is, give me everything that you currently have. What's come into your inboxes? Is there any projects around water movement? Who are your members in your fire department? And I judge reputation on my own. Like, you know, like what Daryl's saying, good, bad, positive. Sometimes people are disliked because truth is painful. You know, like, you know, did the Oakland Fire Department put out fires between the late 70s, 78 when they changed the pump chart, and 1999? Of course. Did anyone notice that the nozzle pressure was wrong or the friction loss was grossly off? No. Did it mean we were flowing what we thought we were flowing? No. Were the fires going out? Yes. But that means there's an uncaptured part in there. So I think what's very important is to have that mindset where you don't know what you don't know, and the chiefs have to have that same kind of mindset. You got to look at your inbox. You got to look at all these moving pieces. And what I find often, Cation, there's some T's that need to be crossed, dots, I's that need to be dotted, maybe even some lowercase J's. But once you get everybody in the room and you say, this is very important, Daryl made this point earlier, what everyone needs to know when you're making these changes, they're not changes for change. The ultimate goal here is to improve the life-saving, right, and property-preserving capacity of the engine company by generating better handline strength. And if I know gauges are going to be inaccurate, or like Daryl saw me at that fire wherever I was doing it, drop one of the crosslays to a gauge where I'd have on the old rigs, you know, a lot of people wouldn't have done something like that. You know, it's level of training, that kind of stuff. You know, where are we missing? But everyone needs to know the ultimate goal is more lives and property are going to be saved if we get. So we need to spend the time to do it. Now, you ask what should people be looking for. I like using examples, okay? West Palm Beach Fire Department, I wasn't paid by them, but I did provide advice to their members. They wanted to make a hose and nozzle page change in their department. It's self-generated up from the rank and below. And one thing, if chiefs listen to this, often these radio shows don't go to the right audience, but I'm going to assume there's some chief of departments and operation chiefs. Empower the rank that uses the equipment. Find the firefighter that uses the equipment that's interested in it, you know, and trust but verify the information that's coming up. But, you know, it doesn't always have to be a company officer or someone who's a chief rank. You know, thermal imaging could be the guy who's really into search, who's been a firefighter forever. You know, all ranks are important in the fire department, and often the best subject matter experts are the people who use the tool. And so West Palm Beach wanted to make a change. I got it up here on my computer in front of me. It says small attack line evaluation, September 2020. There was a Ben Schultz is a firefighter that I knew very well, and Captain D'Angelo. But there's other people on here I don't know very well. Lieutenant Garcia, I'm going to screw some of these names up. But they got a little committee together, Engineer Mosey. Now, look, Firefighter Green, they have a mixture of firefighters, engineers, and company officers. I already know they're off on the right foot. And then I look at their table of contents, target flow, target range, equipment, hose, nozzle, tip, test equipment, the facilities. Then they said evaluation. It says uncharged characteristics, weight. So they broke it down into three different bullet points in their table of contents. Uncharged characteristics, the weight of the hose, the flat width measurement of the hose, the world width of the hose, the flat load height in a Minuteman, the bundle height. Then they said hydraulic performance, friction loss, nozzle pressure and reaction, doorway kink test, kink flow test. So they had these metrics that they're looking at. Then they had subjective evaluation, static handling, attack scenarios, flow and move, hit and move. Then they had committee recommendations. So this is what Daryl's talking about. You have these stakeholders that are the chiefs of the department, and they've been buying, let's say, brand X for 20 years, and fires have been going out. Now you have this committee come back and says, hey, brand X has been good the last 20 years. I know it's everybody likes it. It's their pacifier. It's what they're used to. But if we go to brand Y, the hose is a little smaller. If we change the nozzle, we have more flow. They have to have a report in front of them that basically is going to bring the decision to the no-brainer level. Because what a chief spends when they make these decisions. Everybody always goes to capital. They always go, well, it costs money. That's why, you know, it's hard to do things. That's not true. You can find money in most organizations for changes like this. It might be through attrition or over time. What it really costs the executive ranks of the fire service is political capital. Capital with their employees, capital with the senior captains that have their back when they're pushing down policies that maybe people don't like. And what they want to do is if they're gonna walk out on a branch, they don't want to initiate a change that reduces the life-saving capacity and property-preserving potential of their fire department. So they got to be sure when they make these decisions. And these things, you know, I've been kind of bugging West Palm Beach. It's a great study. There should be an article in Fire Engineering about it. You know, I'll reach out to them again. It's kind of what happened to Jay's article. You know, there's no real rule book when you go out to do this thing. But I think West Palm Beach studies very well. South County, Washington, Todd Weigel and Derek Roberts, I think they have a little thing called the Educated Engine Company, a webpage. They did an extremely good hose and nozzle study inside their department too. So, look for outside resources, try to capture some of these evaluations and duplicate them inside your agency. Often you're going to come to the same results, because the greatest thing about firefighting when you take EMS is there is a most correct answer. There are your measurements you can do. So, you know, you can really back your points with physics and success on the fire ground to make some of these changes happen.
Yeah, I like that, and especially the point about using the, you know, empowering people that are actually using that equipment, because I think not only to get the change made, but then when it actually does get implemented, I think it gets more buy-in that way from the guys within the field too. But I think we put out a lot of information about attack packages and how to build them and to look at doing those evaluations. So two more individual components to talk about tonight. And I want to start with the use of the gated Y, and a lot of people, you know, are still using it. In my job, it's still used. It's not used during standpipe operations, but some companies still use it. Some companies stretch single long lines. Others, you know, they use the gated Y to run two lines off of them with bundles. Daryl, what are your I know you guys did the video, the brass tacks on gated Ys, and that's why I wanted you guys to talk about it a little bit tonight, but. Daryl, why don't you start off and just your thoughts on the gated Y use and where it's at today versus its original design, and and things like that.
Yeah, I came up in another fire department. Prior to working for Oakland, I worked in a suburb, Redwood City. I was a firefighter there for about 7 years. And the gated YOP operation, I know we all have, operations with special names and stuff. Theirs was called the Tank Option 2 because in their drill book, Tank Option 1 was a crossway. Tank Option 2 was a gated Y operation. Never blinked an eye at it in the 7 years I worked there as a firefighter and an engineer. But what I knew is if we needed a line longer than 200-foot pre-connect, then what we were going to do is this gated Y operation. Okay, so fast forward, I come to over here to Oakland, and we still had a gated Y operation, and we had a different name for it. It was called a schoolyard. So terminology matters. Everybody's got something. But we had a 300-foot pre-connect. So when we would do this schoolyard is if it was something beyond the reach of a 300-foot pre-connect. Well, I don't know when all this really kind of grew to be what it's come to be, but I knew when we were making a lot of the changes, it was centered around a small attack hose diameter. We actually reduced the diameter of our large line. We were using a mix of 3-inch or 2.5 because our schoolyard was not just to Y off the small lines, but it could also be to go beyond the 200-foot limitation of our big line. And it was called a big line because it could be 2.5 or 3-inch. So we called it a big line. I have experience in the suburbs of using this gated Y. I come to this city where we're doing it in a different fashion. We're making a lot of changes, and one of the changes we made was to eliminate the 300-foot pre-connect and make it a static bed, adding more hose, so it's a static bed today. And we did the same thing. We eliminated the 200-foot pre-connect at 2.5 and made that a static bed. Very clean. And up until that point, we would use gated Y operations intermittently. But what was apparent to me is every department in the nation or the world for that matter has a need to stretch very long and also has a more common need to stretch very short, because generally in most of the time we could get our apparatus close to whatever the fire is. And I would hear this saying from people that, well, we're set up to do what we do 90% of the time. And I do think sometimes these percentages are just thrown around as if they're fact. But, yeah, we're set up to do what we do a vast majority of the time. The problem is when you have to go to tank option 2 or plan B or a schoolyard or whatever the evolution is to do something different than your 90%, you're asking people to do a more complicated evolution to get the hose a farther distance. So once we implemented the static load, bulk bed, whatever you call it, dead load, I found, well, this is much simpler. It wasn't my idea. It was Jay Camella, who Dennis mentioned earlier, was the one really fighting for this change, and it really made things simple. And it's, why do we need to do something almost completely different to get the hose 100 feet farther or 50 feet farther? And we also need to make that a estimation, because it's an estimation from the rig of which plan we're implementing. 1, 2, A or B, you know, are we doing a pre-connect or a gated Y operation? And we were getting so much success getting a single line into operation quicker And with more focus on that first line, we found that we were now using less lines than we used to. And part of it was that we increased the flows. And I think a bigger part of that was that we were putting a lot of focus on that first line. I think there is a culture that every organization is going to have, and the gated why to a point, I think, is, you know, with respect, like a security blanket. It's, well, if I need a second line, and that you have this option. At no point in time do we ever minimize the need of a second line to be stretched. The belief that the second line coming off of a Y, I think there's a fallacy that it's a second line, because most of the line is the same line. If you have a hose failure, you're going to lose both of your lines. And there's also the thought that the second line is always going to be within the vicinity of the first line. In my first apartment, we had a lot of carports, and the carport would get going and start lighting the apartment on the second floor up. Not only was the second line not in the vicinity, because one's going up the stairs to the apartment and the other one has to go around, you know, the back to the carport, but the second line also needed to be larger because it was an open carport. So we could have a 2.5 in one area and the 1¾ in another area. Having experienced both for many years, undoubtedly the a static bed of 1¾ or 2.5, and then followed up with a second static bed to a new fresh location and starting that up off as a clean stretch is simpler, and it is more redundant because it's two separate lines. They're both operating off of separate gauges, and it in no way hinders the crew's ability to get a second line into operation. So, but besides some of the other components of it, those are some of the main ones. But I also found the first line got into operation faster because we had a lot of the simplicity. We had a lot of 1¾, where on a previous, let's say, 350-foot stretch, we're stretching 250 of that as 2.5 or 3-inch hose with a large Y on the end, and then bringing a bundle up. So it was actually more manpower and personnel intensive than having a static bed of hose.
Yeah, I think that's a huge point. When we started making changes on it, a lot of our focus in order to get the change was on the fact that, you know, a failure with the trunk line would lose both lines, and then also the nozzle reaction changes that occur as one nozzle's shutting down being a safety thing just with modern flows and all. But Dennis, what would you like to add on the Gator Y?
I wrote an article in the Water Supplemental and Fire Engineering in 2019 that finally got published. A lot of stuff I write about in the fire service is controversial, you know, and I think the why is one of those things, like Daryl was saying, it's kind of like a pacifier for a lot of fire departments. They've always used it to make their long stretch, and they think it delivers that second line, which it really isn't a second line. It steals water from the first and relies on the same outlet. It's going to be in the same vicinity, everything that he talked about. But I think one thing that isn't discussed is, you know, it's the time. It's the time. You don't know what you don't know. If you put a static bag on somebody's rig of 1¾, let's say 6 lengths, and you fill it out with some 2.5, and you go, okay, most fires are contained with the first line. The life saved is really how quick the first line gets in the service and did it go to the right location. Is it confining the fire? Is it eventually going to extinguish the fire? You know, in the LECO acronym, right? If you have a dedicated stretch bed for that long small line stretch or that long large line stretch. And it's loaded in a way that pulls similar to a pre-connected line you might pull more often. And you train on it a little bit. You pause and other people get on the line. It's going to be markedly faster. I remember when I was involved in the department in Seattle, and I knew the training chief at the time, and they went out and did all the hydraulic things. They knew they were in automatic nozzles. They said, well, you can gate back and forth, you can use the bail. Hydraulic problems wasn't enough for the Y evolution to be ended in that organization. And I was very confused in that organization. It's another one of those things, look at the history. Like, I was like, why do they have this manifold operation? Why do they rely on Y so often? Why are they stretching like this? And it went back to the history of wooden piers in the city and not being able to drive your fire engines out on that, and how many fires they had down on these wooden piers and these manifold operations. So, you got to look at the history of the Y too. Where did it come from, and why is it not on the pump, which we get into. But back to this timing deal. One thing I learned from the city of Seattle is that even though they're still on a bundle evolution, once they started timing this without the Y and just going to a bell reducer and how fast the line got into place, that was the tipping stone that tipped this thing all the way over. They're like, wow, the line, it was ridiculous. It was like getting in the stirrup. They didn't have to tie the gate open. They didn't have to put it on the ground. They didn't have to make and break an extra connection. So if you're in a Y evolution where you're opening a compartment, you're attaching it, then you're dragging all the, I'm working with a fire department right now, the 150-foot Y pack is over the Y on it. You start looking at all this stuff, and it's costing time on the fire ground. It's a large problem. It's a large problem to getting initial water flowing on fire, and fire loves to grow in the absence of water, right? So, fire will just continue, and then ventilation is windows fail and all this stuff. So I think one of the big problems with the way Ys are currently used in the American Fire Service is they're like this plan B, C thing that you got to open a compartment, you got to make and break, you got to, maybe undo a nozzle off the 2.5-inch stretch bed, and you start adding all this stuff up, and it's just professionally unacceptable behavior to be spec'd and layout like that. To me, it's like you're arriving. Imagine arriving at a fire and just saying, we're going to stop for a minute and do nothing. Or we could arrive at a fire just stretch from a stretch bed that's perfect built. If it takes an extra minute, that's what it means. It means essentially you're giving the fire a 1 minute head start after your arrival because you're stuck in a slower evolution. So not only the hydraulics, there's a lot of strategy and tactics mentioned in that 2019 article that I think that are as bad or worse than the hydraulic consequences of the Y.
I want to add a couple of things because I think this topic has even more to do with the reasons to have a static bed as it has to do with the gated Y. I think anybody that really knows me knows I'm a huge proponent of static beds, non-pre-connected lines. And when asking people why they may prefer a pre-connect, it almost always comes down to time. Well, this is what I would challenge you to do. Pick a fixed location that you pull a pre-connect to. Get that line charged, mask up, get your gloves on, and stop the time from the when you're ready to start engaging in that fire attack. Because generally, one of the longer periods of time is the at the door, your gloves, your mask, your hood, those type of things. Now, the static bed is no slower. It's only thought to be slower. But as a company officer, this takes a huge decision off of my plate when we stretch the static bed. I don't have to be concerned of someone over or under stretching, because with a pre-connect, it is pre-connects work, and they put out fires every day. It's putting out one as we speak right now, I'm sure. Pre-connects put out fire, but I am not an expert in judging distance, and I'm not in knowing every the location of this fire from the rig. So when we make a decision, if it's me or one of my firefighters choosing a line that isn't the proper length, now we're looking at extending it with a bundle. And that's been too widely accepted as fixing a problem that should not have occurred. We shouldn't accept coming up short and then fixing the problem there. Overstretching is also equally as bad of a problem, because now we have an excess amount of hose to flake out, excess kinking, and it comes with its own set of problems. So the simplicity is of certain things, the simplicity is almost scary. The simplicity of a smoothbore nozzle, the simplicity of not having a Y, or the simplicity of make every stretch its own unique stretch. Take what you need, get your 50 to the door. Once you're at the door, if this room is on the third floor of a Victorian, I'm going to pull up another coupling so we have 100 feet available inside, and I'm going to call for water, mask up, get on my gloves. The engineer will break it and connect it. And I do have to give, you know, credit to this, some of this thought process to Jeff Shoup, who most of you guys certainly know the name or have met. When we were, you know, bantering around the idea of going to a static beds, I asked Jeff, what's faster, a pre-connect or the static bed? Because he's worked around different places and said, well, for him, the static bed was, you know, that's all they did in Cleveland. So it was always faster because it put everybody on the same page. I have had times with two firefighters in the back, one go to the rear and another one go to a side crossway. And I basically eliminated that as a problem, saying, hey, we're just always stretching from the static bed. It puts everybody on the same page, and it's very efficient. If you look at, if somebody thinks this may be like a wild idea, let's look at some of our busiest fire departments in our largest cities with a lot of diversity, places like Los Angeles, Detroit, New York. They're not set up for the 90%. They're increasing that to basically 100% of what they do because the rigs are set up to stretch long or short. Departments that are overly reliant on pre-connects end up using gated Ys quite a bit because they have to have something to fix when it's beyond the pre-connect. And when it's those organizations often end up with the debates of how their rig is set up. One company wants to have shorter pre-connects, and another company across town wants to have longer pre-connects. So I think the issue isn't so much of the gated Y, but of static beds.
So Daryl brought in the whole thought process thing, which is a huge time saver on the fire ground too. Everyone be out. And I will bring up a scar that I have from the Oakland hose change. And I don't know if Daryl will remember this, but I think he will. I came from a couple different fire departments before I got to Oakland. Often the two pre-connected crossways were 200 feet. And, if you pull the 200, can the 150 back up the 200? Yeah, if it's the fire's not greater than 150 feet away from the rig, but it's not good practice, right? So, you know, in Oakland, often, you know, the city was varied. So, you know, the East End had a 150. Sometimes they even put 150 on the front bumper, so they had two 150s, and then they had a 200 crossway. And sometimes you'd go work downtown, and the first crossway would be 250 feet because their buildings were bigger, and we had that weird variety. So, you know, we were going to get rid of that. We wrote a policy that specified the length because we were adding a static bed, so that solved that problem. But one thing we did try was both pre-connects to be 200 feet so they could back up each other. That's one of the reasons the chick stand swivel exists in a crossway. They're supposed to have the same stress potential. By the way, for the people who are in Minuteman loads out there, if you have them directionally loaded where you can only pull them one way, there is about a 30-foot difference between crossway number one and crossway number two. They cannot act as their backup to each other in the same stretch potential. So often as a consultant, I'll add a static bed to the back and say, hey, if you're pulling a true secondary line that's going to be a backup line, it needs to be able to stretch one length longer, always go to the static bed. Don't pull the other crossway. And often I'll design a static bed that's a ripoff of the Minuteman. But overstretching, pulling a 200-foot pre-connect for a fire that really only requires three lengths of hose is a huge time suck on the fire ground, and it's dangerous. You can kink. We've had several fires in the American Fire Service where long pre-connect led to significant loss of life and property, up to including line of duty death. That was Oscar Armstrong was cited. That was cited in his fire. That, you know, they pulled a very long pre-connect and it was very, very kinked up. They also stretched dry into an involved two-story structure. So I've worked in the DC Beltway. A lot of people put 350s or 400s on their rigs, and I'll see them pull the line and it ends up only being a 250 stretch and they got to get rid of 150 feet of hose. Well, it's okay if it's a big grass beltway, but it's not very good if you're on the second story of the building. So static lines. I just found out Montreal, Canada, very complicated cities, all static as well. You know, working towards simplicity can pay huge dividends on the fire ground. And if everybody's on the same page, everybody's going to the same place. You know, if Oakland happened to be all static bed, you get a made-to-order stretch every time. So the bungalow fire might only be two lengths of hose. And that Victorian fire Daryl mentioned might be five lengths of hose. And a lot of fires might be three lengths of hose. And if you would teach one evolution on the drill tower, this is how you stretch the static 1¾ inches. This is how you stretch the static 2¼. And we kind of stretch it the same way, but the 2¼ gets the second company backing it up. Well, then if you can only practice 10 hours a year and you only have two evolutions, you get 5 hours of drill in each evolution. If you have five evolutions, it means you only get 1 hour of drill on each of those evolutions. So that increases training retention and performance on the fire ground. So the human component that Daryl brings up is immense, especially from the company officer's perspective.
Yeah, so that's kind of what we do. I mean, we have pre-connects, and then we also have a static bed off the rear. And I do the same thing Daryl was talking about is – at least I can't say for everybody, but on our crew, we're going to stretch from the static bed every time. And this way we can take what we need at each fire. And it's that repetition the stretch is the same other than the length every time. It's not which one are we going to. They know which one they're pulling. They know how to pull it. And that's what we're going to do. So they can get really good at that skill. So we got one last topic I want to definitely get into because I had some specific people specifically asked me to get into this topic. So, Dennis, I want to start with you because I know you can get into it about this with some detail and explain it to people pretty well. But the idea of the high-velocity master streams.
Yeah. Well, we're going to run out of time. So, like, you know, I'm gonna do this as simple as possible, kind of like that baseball tennis ball analogy. All right. So if we know that you're getting roughly – you're getting a million BTUs per minute of heat absorption per 100 gallons. So if you look at 800 gallons a minute and you go like, okay, 800 gallons a minute, that's million BTUs per minute. There's nothing in the structural fire environment that if you can actually get the full 800 gallons a minute to that surface in a, let's say 5x5 footprint, you know, like somewhere tight in the stream, 25 square feet, right? Nothing's not going to go out. You're going to work that little cool spot from the front of the big building, and you can work away from that, and the fire is going to go out. The problem is getting the water there, and the problem is developing on the fire ground. If you have three hydrants in the commercial area, and each of them can generate 2,000 GPM, and you put up five master streams, and they're all trying to flow 1,250, you're out of water, right? And you have no water for a hand line. So how much water do you actually need? And then automatic nozzles often get delivered on elevated sinks. And an automatic nozzle known as a compressor nozzle should have another nickname. It's a constant velocity nozzle. And most master stream automatic nozzles are either 75 PSI or 80 PSI. They're on a lower nozzle pressure because they're worried about reaction force and aerials. And as they flow more water, they want to keep that nozzle pressure down because they're flowing more mass, which will give you more reach, but that's more friction loss in the waterway, and it's not at any faster speed. So a lot of people don't know this, but a 75 PSI master stream automatic nozzle under its design standard and its flow curve can be plus or minus 15 PSI. So minus 15 PSI, it's 60 PSI. I mean, it's like hand line speed. You know, you're going to be at like 100 feet per second or less. Like, that's not a good way to develop a heavy stream. I don't know what they're thinking. Now, imagine you have a pickup truck driving down the freeway, bed full of gravel, right? You're pouring concrete or something, and you need a cubic yard of gravel at the work site to get your job done, okay? Now, an automatic nozzle, right, as you increase throttle to it, that baffle opens more. So more volume's going through it, but it's not speeding up. So imagine that pickup truck driving down the freeway, and you're just dumping extra gravel into the back of it, but it's not speeding up at all. It's going to arrive at the work site at the same time, right? The person driving that pickup cannot press the accelerator down. Okay, now, if you take a smooth bore tip, all right, what a lot of people don't understand is it's a fixed orifice, but it's variable gallonage, variable reaction force, and variable velocity. Velocity on a smooth bore tip, actual tip pressure is actual discharge velocity. There's no hurdles to run through, like on an automatic fog nozzle or even a fixed orifice fog nozzle. A lot of people don't understand that. Master stream fog nozzle with 80 PSI inlet pressure doesn't have 80 PSI discharge pressure. The water has to run around the stem first, right? So there was a guy who studied fire streams from New Zealand, and when Jason Vessel wrote his handline article, Quantitative Selection in Handline Nozzles, there's a quote from this researcher in New Zealand. Nothing develop a fire stream more efficiently than a tapered piece of pipe, right? Just tapers down, which is causing acceleration. Now, imagine that same pickup truck going down the freeway, and you're going to that job site, and that job site needs that gravel, but it needs it now, right? As you increase throttle, what you're getting is you're adding a little gravel to the back of the pickup truck, but now the pickup truck's going from 55 miles an hour to 60 miles an hour to 80 miles an hour to 90 miles an hour. So it's going to be getting there quickly, okay? Now, remember, the convection column has a lot of heat in it, okay? It has a lot of wind. It has a lot of radiant heat, right? It has a lot of convective heat. It's trying to tear apart that stream. So now, that's the pickup analogy. You're going to get the gravel. How much gravel do you need? Do you need extra gravel, or do you just need that one cubic yard to hit that one spot to get that out and then work it away? So you're accelerating the ability. Now, it's going to spend less time in the heat, so there's going to be less evaporation. More stream is going to reach the surface. Now, the other thing, right, how much mass do you need, right? So if you went deer hunting or something, right, and the deer's across the field, and you look at the grain rate of a shotgun slug, well, that's like an automatic master stream with the baffle all the way open, right? And you look at muzzle velocity. Well, sure, the slug probably will get across the field, but is there any accuracy to it? Are you going to hit what you're shooting at, you know, And how long did it take you to develop that water supply to get that heavy stream? Because the only way to increase reach is to increase volume substantially in an automatic nozzle. Then you look at the deer, what you really need is a high pressure round, a high velocity round to go. You don't need a lot, right? The bullet size doesn't have to be big to kill the deer. Now, I've had these discussions for years, and I've been teaching, you know, like Brian Brush has his exponential indica. He loves the inch and a half tip on the deck gun, and he'll go rooms of fire, 150 gallons a minute. Floors of fire, 300 gallons a minute, and then he'll go buildings of fire or larger, 600 gallons a minute, and it really works out nice for his article. You know, it's like 7/8, inch and a quarter, and then inch and a half. And I go, well, why not have an inch and 3/8 tip and double the pressure? An inch and 3/8 tip, why don't you change your article, Brian, or your thinking, and you go, hey, an inch and 3/8 tip at 100 PSI is 560 gallons a minute. That's double your hand line stream. But now it's double your nozzle pressure. You have when I design a rig, a couple things I look at is like, the best you can do right now is you can do a 900-pound nozzle reaction riser. Akron and TFT makes them. And you can do a 200 PSI plumbing system all the way to the nozzle. Well, that means you can run an inch and a half nozzle from 40 PSI all the way to 200 PSI. 200 PSI is 1,000 gallons a minute. It's 700 pounds nozzle reaction. Right now you're using the horsepower in the rig to actually fling the water harder, farther, right? And it's traveling quicker, right? Now, I've been teaching this for a long time, and people go like, are there good field examples of where this works? I get calls all the time after I teach a pumping class, people who are master stream fires. And by the way, you want to be able to underpump your tip too. One of the things that people say about automatic nozzles is it preserves reach. Hey, I don't want reach. Who's been to a master stream fire where the stream's going over the building? If I have an inch and a half tip on the rig and I only pump it at 50 PSI, well, I'm still getting 500 gallons a minute and it's only 177 pounds of nozzle reaction, but I've changed the breakover. Now it's being lobbed into those buildings. I'm extinguishing what's close to me. Hey, I yell down the engineer, hey, give me 50 extra pounds up. Now I'm putting some stuff out in the field. Hey, and Kurt Isaacson kind of puts these kiddie pools out, you know, watering the fire. And you can show how manipulating throttle, you can get the water to go different places on the fire ground, right? So you can't move a master stream like you can move a hand line, right? So Ray McCormick says there's nozzle reach. And then there's stream reach. Nozzle reach is advancing into your extinguishment. The nozzle is going to eventually make the seed of the fire. You're not going to lift up the engine and drive it into the structure. So one of the ways you can enhance stream reach is by varying velocity and speed. So the most recent big win in this type of discussion is if you Google it or you talk to Jay Bonifield, he was the firefighter in the bucket. They had a big fire in Everett, Washington, and it was the stick framed building under construction. We've seen them over and over again. They pull up and one's going really well, and the sister building that's still not skinned next door is smoking, and they put their tower right between the exposure and the big burning pile of lumber. And usually what happens is the truck gets damaged, the paint gets burned out off it, and then you burn down both. So he's up there in the bucket. They had a 2-inch tip, and he gets to 80 PSI, which is 1,000 gallons a minute, and he says he's burning up in the bucket. He's on the squawk box. He's like, give me more pressure. Give me more pressure. And we've talked about that type of aerial and how much pressure would stay at the tip. And he said when the 2-inch tip got to around 120, 130 pounds, he got a little cool spot on the, started getting more comfortable in the bucket. He started working away around from that. You get your little toehold of extinguishment. They saved that exposure building. Like literally, it's probably like a $30 million save, or, you know, $20 million save. And if they just followed the book, if they just kept it at 80 PSI, they would have burnt that building down. And was it the extra 200 gallons a minute that made that little cool spot? I would argue no. It's the increase in speed got the water to the burning surface. So Matt Scallion, kind of Kurt Eisen's right-hand man, it's a lot of these conferences, Lieutenant Nick Scammy, actually he might be a captain now, let's just call him a captain. He says, I like my inside water slow and my outside water fast. And I would say that's a pretty accurate statement. I think we've been doing heavy streams, too GPM focused and not placement enough focused for decades based on old equipment with much less capacities and horsepower, nozzle reaction, abilities. And the books are just wrong. That's my two cents.
I love it. And I like anytime you talk about it and let people understand what they can gain by, you know, changing that pressure to get velocity out of it and what that gain really is. Daryl, you got anything you want to add on that topic?
Yeah, it's funny. I remember having a ground monitor on the ground when I was, you know, into hydraulics and all. It's maybe my second year in the fire department. We're at this 99-cent store that, you know, it's gone. There's an apartment building in the back on the Charlie side of the building. I'm on the Alpha side. Dream, and I'm telling the engineer, yeah, up. Okay, 60, 70. 80 PSI, perfect, you know, stop right there. And then I hear on the radio, like, hey, whoever's on that master stream, you're hammering us on the apartment building in the back. The stream was just shooting directly over the building. And that's when it was really like, okay, sometimes hydraulics can get go a little too far. You know, stand to the side, make sure the wet stuff's landing on the red stuff. And I would have been much better off to look at rather than looking at the gauge. So that was a, you know, real world experience for me. I guess one question I would have is, I would caution using some of these master streams at high velocities when they're not mounted to an object. So ladders and deck guns they're mounted, but when we're getting into rams or ground on a threshold of reaction where we lose the ability of that the ground unless it's tied off or something. But yeah, the ham lines are very
100% accurate.
Yeah, and once we get into deck guns, I think things like a deck gun, it's just more important, more on the stream than the pressure. The other thing, and I guess I'll pose this question to Dennis, is the 80 PSI wrong? And where does the 50 and 80 PSI historically come into play for smoothbore master streams?
I think... you know, when I was hired in Oakland, they still had a lot of trucks in service from the late 70s and early 80s. And, you know, the inch and three-quarter tip, it said don't take it above 70 PSI at certain extensions of the old steel C-grade ladders that were light duty. If you look at, you know, John Freeman or the early Chicago master streams and some of those agencies, they really viewed them as a variable nozzle pressure once they were fixed mounted. And a lot of this initial knowledge came from hydraulic mining of placer gold in California, in the Western United States. That's where heavy streams really were developed. It was in search of money, not extinguishing fire. And the higher the tip pressure, the better. So those mounts would be hammered into the ground. You know, you want to transfer force from the nozzle to what you're hitting, right? You know, one of those things that you want to be careful about with master streams is how much water you're putting in a building. And there's been a lot of lost life in the fire service in the overhaul stage collapsed, you know, from adding so much water. As you increase nozzle velocity instead of increasing gallonage, you might actually extinguish a fire with total water weight inside a building. But that's a real nuanced point. I think what you're trying to ask is why is AEPSI in the books? And it probably goes all the way back to steam pumpers that operating in a really high pressure would be like 120 PSI, and then you would have friction loss in the hose. And then, you know, people go, well, they, you know, the tip is at 20 PSI. I got a book out in front of me. It's the actual people probably don't have these things anymore, but this is the actual catalog from Akron, and I'm on page 160, and they list all their smoothbore nozzles in the master stream. They show them from 40 to 200. Well, why is the manufacturer show them the 4200, and why is Akron rate their equipment to 200 PSI? Well, and their vertical mount on their master stream are 900, 3-inch risers are 900, and their 4-inch risers, I think, are something ridiculous, like 1,500 pounds when you build an engine. You know, well, why is that? Well, they expect the professional person to do what you described. You know, like you're going to run your master stream at a pressure that gets water on the seat of the fire as best you can at the nozzle pressure that is required based on reach, breakover, distance inside the building. And they've given you a system that will safely deliver the water at all these different pressures and velocities. You talk to a manufacturer, they'll have, oh, yeah, we have no problem doing that. That's why we designed it, because our riser can handle 900 pounds, and if you want to run the inch and a half tip to 200, knock yourself out. Go ahead. So I don't know. I was never a paramedic. Daryl was a paramedic. I don't know if Anthony was, but I remember there was
no,
a company
not,
officer.
I'm not.
Okay. One of the drug gave after a successful resuscitation from cardiac arrest when I was in the fire service was a thing called dopamine. And they said, well, you just titrate for effect until you get a blood pressure back. Is there any dosage? There's a starting dosage. I kind of look at fixed mounted master streams like that. You pick a tip size that makes sense, and you give it a flow range, which gives you a different velocities and reach. And then you tell your personnel, like on a pump chart I'll develop, I look at the engine stock in a department, and I'll say, hey, you can run all of your engines are safe to run your inch and a half tip from 40 to 175, and your inch and three quarter tip from 40 to 150, and your 2-inch tip from 40 to 100. And then I'll tell them, you look at what's going on with the fire. You're not inside the building. You have all these visual cues until you get a good result within the performance of your equipment. So, you know, I almost think like the 80 PSI master stream is like giving somebody a piano and just teaching them how to play chopsticks. You know, that's it. And nothing else. It's like, or giving someone a guitar and teaching them like three chords and that's it. And, you know, it's a musical instrument. The engine itself from the supply side to the handline side is a musical instrument. And you need to practice, you need to experiment, and you need to develop knowledge and understanding so you can develop good streams from handline to master stream and develop good supply as well. And it's, you know, it's a fashionable, and you have to understand that the level that is taught in Firefighter 1 and Firefighter 2 and basic pump school just gets you to a basic level of competency. There are the Jimi Hendrix of the world that can do fantastic things with the same equipment because they have better knowledge and they've practiced more and they can do more stuff. They can play better music.
We still got everybody. Oh. It sounds like it went dead. Okay.
So, I think Daryl was driving.
Yeah, I heard a dead noise there. I didn't know if we lost everybody, but as we close it out,
pick up.
Yeah, I heard him say that earlier. So, We closed it out.
Where is
here he is. He just came back in. His mic's coming back up. All right, Daryl, you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Did you hear Dennis's explanation for you?
Yes, I did.
Okay.
And,
I didn't know if you lost you there for a minute.
Yeah. One thing I wanted to add is just caution people to know that this doesn't necessarily carry over to hand lines. With hand lines, we get to this breaking point of what firefighters can handle for nozzle reaction. And to lower the nozzle reaction, we either need to keep tip pressure high and lower the volume of water, or we're lowering the nozzle pressure and keeping the volume of water high. So, and this is one reason maybe why, Chief Brush focuses on, different tip pressures to keep that volume high, still at 50 PSI tip pressure, not increase the nozzle reaction force. But I would say that this topic probably does warrant the next UL study. There hasn't, to my knowledge, been much study on nozzle velocity. I know with regards to firearms, you can look at the difference of velocity from a rimfire 22 pistol versus an AR, which is still a 22 just coming out at much higher velocity, and the difference that it makes. We can look at ballistic gels and things like that. But when it comes to water flow and different velocities, I think that's going to warrant some more studies and education.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, too.
I have been in contact with researchers at the UL, and it is a big question mark in velocity. And even in, and Daryl's 100% with hand lines. The one greatest advantage of hand line is you have what Ray coined the term as nozzle reach. You can advance into your footprint of extinguishment. So you might want to be focusing on GPM, cooling around you and advancing forward. There's a little question mark as the compartment gets bigger. That's one of the reasons pulling a ram to a roll-up door instead of two and a half initially might make a big difference because of not only the extra water, but the velocity. So it is a question mark. Daryl's example of ballistic gels and the two equal-weighted 22s fired at different velocities is a perfect example of where the greatest thing about the fire service is that, there's an open question mark. We have to remain students. And, I think going to be interesting. Large compartment fire, velocity might be more important than people think.
All right. So I think we gave everybody, or you guys did, a ton of information tonight. So as we close it out, everyone, I'll just go through everyone kind of your final thoughts that you want to close out the show with. To start it, I just want to thank both of you for coming on it. I think the amount of information you guys dropped for everybody that was listening tonight or everyone that downloads it later and listens to it is an amazing amount of information for a two-hour time frame. So I definitely want to just thank you guys for coming on and taking your time out of your day to do that. And my final thoughts for anyone listening, if you listen to this, it's a big system. It's not individual components that you just pick and choose and replace. It all has to work together as a system, and you always have to look at it in that mindset that it's a big package, and not to look at an individual, just a nozzle or just a hose or just a master stream tip. They're all just a component of a system or of a package, and you have to look at and evaluate the entire package. So, Daryl, you got any final thoughts you'd like to close out the show with?
Yeah. One is, keep looking over the fence and keep, moving forward, because in no industry do things stay stagnant. There's a saying that I'm forgetting the saying. I'm driving as I'm talking. I apologize. But if you keep doing the same thing and expect a different result. That is the definition of insanity. But I think in our profession, it's almost opposite. If you keep doing the same thing and expect the same result, that could be insane because our buildings are changing. The things inside of our buildings are changing. The equipment we use is changing. So we cannot keep doing the same thing. We have to look over the fence and consider what else may be able to be done. So empower your people to try things. If you are a officer or a chief or somebody that can approve people to do, try things, nozzles, hose, master streams, whatever, let them try it. Nothing is crazy. Your building fires will go out, but we do need to evaluate this stuff in the real world. I'm fortunate that I'm allowed to do that on my job and put things on my rig and try things. But also just, as we said earlier, keep an open mind, keep trying things, listen to people, put good people around you. And there's no perfect system, but look not for a wholesale change, but look for incremental improvements to make your job better than it was.
Awesome. And
yeah,
Dennis, you got any final thoughts?
Yeah, I just kind of echo some of Daryl's points. You know, incremental change, ensure when you initiate change that the training is done, it's well supported, because failure of new equipment, I've seen a lot of good new equipment get villainized, not because of the equipment that, you know, wasn't supported properly, it wasn't rolled out correctly. Also, when he was talking about, like, always looking over the fence, like, one thing that you have to understand as a human being is that, failability. Like, you know, there's going to be positions that you've taken, and I've definitely been there in the fire service, where you were incorrect, you know, and that's okay. You know, one must understand that, you know, failability is part of life, and that's why you should be smart enough when you don't know the answer to reach out. One of the things I think I get a little bit too much credit for when people listen to me talk, or we get down to, you know, some of the physics around this, a lot of this stuff is just based on doggedly interacting with people over and over again. Like, you know, an old pump operator explained something to me that just made so much sense. You know, pumps push water, they don't pull water. So that's why at large fires, you got to have a pump on the hydrant. You know, it's not the hydrant's job to push water down to you. It works fine. Some of these analogies and stuff, I've traveled more places and had a larger open mindset and realized that I'm failable. And some of the things that I hold true might not be 100% accurate or might need to be refined. Now, one thing that I do find a little bit frustrating is, you know, ignorance is okay. You know, ignorance is bliss, right? That's life, you know, but negligence is not okay. Like, once somebody has categorically made evident that what you're doing is substandard, right? But maybe it's culturally acceptable. One thing to me is like the gated Y. You know, if you're going to use a gated Y, everybody teaches you to tie open the side that you opened. Well, I've seen plenty of closed sides with no cap on the other side get kicked open. So one of the things that I did when I was in Oakland, we were still using Y operations, I would go get old 1.5-inch caps off the boneyard rigs, and I'd drill a little 1/8-inch hole in it, and I'd screw it on the other side of the Y. Because as a pump operator, that took a danger out of the equation, right? When someone points something out like that, something simple like that out to you, and you don't go out and do it, to me, that's negligent. You know, once something is so clearly, you can do something that has such clear benefit, that's negligent, right? So understand that ignorance is okay, that you're failable, but, you know, if something becomes, and it's very tough as a firefighter, there are going to be things that you know are negligent, and you're going to, after you've done some training somewhere, and you're just going to try to not do it yourself. Like, a perfect example for this would be like penciling during high heat conditions, and then you go somewhere and it's like, no, You know, a closed nozzle flows no water. Don't be stingy with the solution. Open it. You know, you can work from that point on at a personal level not to operate in a negligent fashion, right? But you can also spread that message. So I love Daryl's line of thought, like, you know, crazy because things are changing. I've never heard anyone go counterculture or contrarian on that same definition. That's awesome. Like, I just learned something today. So I'm leaving happy. You heard me giggle a little bit there. I'm leaving happy. Daryl, stop me something again.
Well, to end the show, the last thing I want to say again is just thank you to both of you guys for coming on, taking time to pass on your information to people. No, I really appreciate it. I know Todd really appreciates that, even though he couldn't be here. And we'll talk soon and hopefully see each other soon. And you guys have a good night.
Thanks, Anthony.
All right, thank you. Thank you. Thank you both.